got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your co-host, Cameron English.
And I'm the other co-host, Kevin Folta, who really is concerned that you understand what's happening in the current state of science.
And today we're talking a lot about coronavirus and a little bit about pesticides. First up, is the cure worse than the disease when it comes to containing COVID-19? Scammers are peddling fake coronavirus treatments, so we're going to go over the products you need to be on the lookout for. And then, can you catch COVID-19 from your food? The answer is probably not, and we're going to dig into that. And then finally, Environmental Working Group just released its infamous Dirty Dozen list. And so, as we do each year, we're going to explain why you probably don't need to worry about pesticide residues on your food. So, Kevin, let's start with this first story. This is Dr. David Katz in the New York Times talking about why the cure might be worse than the disease when it comes to COVID-19. So what was your take on this story?
Yeah, it was rather interesting to read because it provides an alternative viewpoint, which we've heard reflected by several politicians. And I think, you know, when I read this, I understand where he's going. Basically, the idea that Katz proposes is that we shouldn't necessarily be shutting down everything because of the economic consequences. And I don't think that he's necessarily talking about things like, you know, stock market or things like that, like many worry about. I think he's looking at the long-term effects on families who lose jobs and that kind of thing, you know, with the way it's going to affect the average person and how it'll affect schools and children and, you know, all the things that are happening that are extremely, catastrophic in many ways for many families. I think that's what he's referring to. What he suggested was, rather than just go with social distance and, you know, like they're talking about, which really means physical distance, what if you could protect the most vulnerable? Because the disease is really affecting and harming. The highest mortality rates are amongst the elderly. So when you get into the 60s and 70s and higher, you see it having a greater effect, especially with those who have already health compromises, things like heart conditions or diabetes. So Katz proposes test all of them, find the ones who are harboring the disease, start them on the most up-to-date treatments, give them the best care, send the rest of them home to isolate, and everybody else, life is normal.
Now, one criticism I've heard of this position is that it just might be too late for something like this. Like if it was late January, you know, an approach like that could work, but now it's just beyond that, you know, I mean, we're in a full blown pandemic at this point. So what do you think of that point?
Well, I agree with that. If in late January, there are even the tests available to do what Katz proposes. And I think what he's really writing here is kind of a Monday morning quarterbacking with the idea that we should have thought about these things a little better in the first place, that if you had the capacity to be able to test the elderly population and provide guidance and test others who are in connection with them, maybe things would have been a little bit different. Right now, he kind of does say the cat's out of the bag and we got to deal with this as we got to deal with it. But that was his original idea, was that, you know, there's things like theaters and restaurants and small businesses that will never reopen again. And that it's really unfortunate to have had that loss as a collateral effect of a pandemic virus.
Now, to his credit, he came out afterwards on Twitter after writing this, and he said, you know, I don't want to just lift these isolation orders willy-nilly. We need to be paying attention to what the numbers are and what epidemiologists are telling us. So, I mean, do we have any idea of when it might be safe to let people start getting back to work, or is it just too soon to tell how serious that could be?
Yeah, well, I think that's everything I've read on this is that there is no easy metric to tell. that you have to be looking at how much it's spreading in the population and whether you have the capacity to deliver health care to the people who need it. An article this week in the New England Journal of Medicine talked about the horrors of having to ration health care. Right now, they're anticipating 1.4 or need for one ventilator for every 1.4 to 31 people. And what that means is that someone's going to have to make decisions about who's going to get to use that equipment and who's going to not use it. So this may be a life or death decision-making matrix, and I think that's not where anybody wants to go. So right now, the safest thing, staying away from other people.
I did see a study that was just published in The Lancet on March 25th. And what they seem to recommend based on a new modeling study is that we could try lifting certain aspects of the distancing programs that are in place and just see what how does that affect the spread of the disease? Does it get worse? Does it get better? But they said that lifting it all at one time would probably be a really big problem because it would just cause another spike in infections. What do you think about that?
No, it makes sense. And, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist. That's total magic in my book. Great respect for folks who play in that space because the statistics are horrible. But nowadays, the idea being that, and I understand this concept, is that if you can find populations that are not as vulnerable, that have access to medical care if needed, to lift those and see how that change affects the penetration of the disorder could at least provide us with a microcosm of how this thing moves through populations where it's not regulated. But also looking at places like Italy and looking at what happened in China have been extremely important for people to understand how the disease moves within a population.
So maybe then, and again, just to stress, I'm not an expert on this, and Kevin is a geneticist, but not an epidemiologist. So, you know, don't take what we're saying as gospel, but it just seems like the best thing for now, at least, is just to stay put, because it's only been, I'm in California, so we've been in shelter in place for just under 2 weeks now. And so do we just need to give this a little bit of time to work before we start losing our heads and worrying about the economy collapsing?
I think you need data points, right? And that's really what we're collecting is, you know, how is this thing, and it's still growing. It's still going up in many areas or most areas. New York looks extremely hard hit. And by the time this podcast airs, you know, we'll know a lot more. But, you know, we should mention that, you know, we're recording on March 27th, and the story may be very different when this comes out. But, you know, right now that's where we are. We're watching this thing move through populations. And we'll know more once we know more. I mean, it's a horrible feeling.
Now, just before we move on, I was hoping to get your take on this. It seems more now than ever, there are people commenting on this that have no credentials and no expertise, you know, and I just qualified that we're just reporting what the experts are saying. But there's a lot of people on websites like Medium, you know, they might work in software engineering, or they have some kind of background in mathematics. And so they think that that qualifies them to comment on this. And they're getting a lot wrong from what I'm reading on Twitter from actual epidemiologists. So what's your thought on that? It just seems irresponsible to me, and maybe a little arrogant to weigh in on this and say, oh, this isn't that big of a deal. You know, just look at the numbers.
Yeah. Well, in the age where everyone is an expert, except the experts. Funny how that works, right? That there really is a problem because of people make these arguments from authority. And we'll see in some of the later stories how that's extremely perilous. And I was really happy to see the Twitter hashtag ask an actual epidemiologist or an epidemia, whatever it was. Do you remember what it was? Hashtag an actual epidemiologist. And I think that was it. Yeah, that's a really important one for us to look at.
Yeah, and I've been following a few people who I know are who can really speak on this authoritatively, like Jeffrey Cabot, for example, is an epidemiologist. And what I've been seeing is that they're so annoyed with what's going on because they're trying to study this in real time, as you just said. You know, it's evolving day by day. And you have these people on blogs, effectively, some who have a large platform like Elon Musk, and they're just, you know, they're kind of wantonly throwing these comments out, and it's just, the experts are like, hey, you know, slow your roll.
Yeah, no, I think the folks that you should be looking at, another really good one is Natalie Dean. And Natalie Dean is a professor here at the University of Florida, where I'm at. And she's at Natalie X Dean on Twitter. And she actually uses the hashtag an actual epidemiologist, which is fantastic. She had a very important role in Ebola. So she's been there before with this and is another great source of information.
Yeah, and the final one I'll add is Carl Bergstrom. And on Twitter, he is at @CT_Bergstrom. And he has some expertise in this too. And so he's been linking to other authorities on this, and he's been breaking down some of these questionable articles that are making their way around social media. So definitely follow all those people and listen to what they're saying. Don't listen to, you know, the media, certainly, you know, or at least be critical. And then if you see something on social media, then you just need to, it's guilty until proven innocent, I think.
No, I agree 1,000%. The data are still coming in. We saw how South Korea's approach contrasted against what happened in Italy and then what exploded in China. Now we'll watch it happen here in the States. And from this, we need to take careful notes. Don't forget what's happening and use this opportunity to reinvent the way we respond to pandemics, but also the way we respond to economic threats. And you know, are there other ways that we as individuals can better fortify ourselves? I think there's a lot of people saying, you know, I needed a few months to cover mortgage and everything else, you know, the folks who are paycheck to paycheck. I think you're going to see a little different approach after this. And, you know, then again, I said the same thing after 9/11 and nothing changed. So, except we had to wait in airport lines.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, situation evolving in real time, listen to the experts, and we just really have to follow the data, you know, before we make any decisions. But to stay on this theme of people that have no idea what they're talking about, let's talk a little bit about these fake coronavirus treatments. This is a story from Steve Salzberg at Field of Science, and he's talking about dozens of quote-unquote cures and treatments that have been proposed, everything from essential oils to, colloidal silver. You know, I mean, all this kind of stuff, there's no proof or no evidence that any of this works. So Kevin, I mean, what are these people recommending? First of all, let's start there.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm recommending is that if we do get into a situation where we have to decide who gets a ventilator and who doesn't, I think if we're looking at people who have been deliberately deceiving others into buying products that can't work, and taking their money and harming people, I kind of think these folks get to the back of the line. And so that's just my two cents. And a lot of people have said that's really harsh for you to say that. How could you? You know, I'm sorry. You know, if we get down to making choices like that, or they have to make choices, I heard anecdotally that there are some places in New York that if you were in cardiac arrest, that they were assigning do not resuscitate orders if you were positive for corona, but I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, let's go down this list. There are folks like Jim Baker, who's served prison time for misleading the public. Other folks who are hawking these alleged therapies. Most of them are herbal, aromatherapy based, all of these kinds of dubious approaches. Mega doses of vitamin C, elderberry extracts, others that say gargling with Himalayan sea salt eliminates the virus. But Salzberg's article really just covered the seven that the FDA pointed out. And the FDA pointed out seven specific examples of vendors that on Facebook and Twitter and their websites were selling alleged therapies. And in retaliation for that, the FDA sent them a warning letter.
You have Team America where we're talking about, what is it, Kim Jong-il, and the UN is going to send him a very angry letter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, because, you know, these folks who are doing this, and you have to ask the question, and Steven Salzberg, who I've actually co-authored a paper with once, he's very gentle in how he puts this. And, you know, he says, a quote is saying, you know, whether people are selling bogus cures because they truly believe their own statements or whether they're just liars who know they're selling nonsense. And really the idea of stupid or liar is the question. You know, are these people who are, they're true believers, they just don't know, and they believe they're doing something correct? Or are these folks who know that the stuff in the bottle is BS and that they're deliberately lying to people? And if that's the case, the second one, you know, I can kind of excuse somebody from being ignorant of evidence, you know, that happens. That's my job, is to fix that. But the ones who already know and are deliberately selling products that can't work, there's a special place in hell for those folks. And I'd love to see a little more teeth in the law to remedy that situation.
Yeah, and you know, that's actually a really good point. And I wasn't aware of this, or at least it wasn't on my mind, but the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission, they have very limited ability to regulate how these products are marketed because the alternative health industry is worth billions of dollars. And so unsurprisingly, they try to protect those profits by lobbying Congress to make sure that they have a lot of leeway. And it's always sold under this banner of quote unquote health freedom. And I personally find that irritating, you know, because you're taking a valid concept like individual liberty and, you know, people making their own decisions, and then you're selling garbage underneath that banner. So I thought that was an interesting aspect that doesn't get talked about as much. And that also just really drove me nuts. What are your thoughts on that aspect of it?
Well, sure, that's true. And also the idea of personal choice when it comes to your medication. You know, that if something, you don't want the government to be saying you are not allowed to have this. But this is that gray area where here's something that is truly useless. Colloidal silver, they're claiming that this kills antibiotic bacteria, flu, Zika virus. I mean, these claims are on these websites, and a heavy implication that it cures coronavirus, which there's nothing that's been shown to cure it. There's nothing. And on one particular website that I found, they say coronavirus was caused by 5G. So having the boosted cell phone thing is where it came from. Because that makes a lot of sense. and then that you can cure it with elderberry extract, you know, or this Himalayan sea salt, or this whatever this stuff is called, chaga, some sort of a mushroom extract. It is mind-numbing to me, and it's so horrible because there are people who are so afraid right now. I think the fear is maybe a little bit extreme. I mean, it's wild just being out in stores around where I am. The amount of masks and precautions people are under, it's pretty scary. So these folks are taking advantage of that fear.
Well, let me ask you a devil's advocate question. And I've been asked this before because I did an interview a couple of years ago and the audience was not particularly open to what I had to say. And so I got questions afterwards from people and they're like, okay, Mr. Science Man, you know, how do you know if a treatment works or not? And why can I trust scientists at the CDC? You know, these people lie all the time. So how do you handle an objection like that, Kevin? Is there an objective way that people can assess when a treatment is useful and when it's just nonsense?
Yeah, it's tough for the average person because there's so much what looks like authoritative information online, you know, so much stuff that just appears to be super clean and sometimes even cites peer-reviewed literature. So it makes it extremely difficult. And I think the only thing you really can do is look for evidence in peer-reviewed literature that's reproducible by independent groups. And you know, that can be tough to do. So reach out to a scientist, reach out to folks who know this stuff, read the scientific literature and legitimate scientific websites. Listen to the CDC, you know, the WHO, you know, I always like when they did the WHO, make sure you're not fooled again or you won't be fooled again. Right. Yeah, they should make those bumper stickers. But that's really tough to do. So you just have to be extremely careful that you're listening to the right people in these cases, because otherwise it just turns into a big experiment.
Yeah. Well, speaking of not the right people, I think Alex Jones, God love him. He came out and he said that he has a toothpaste that, quote, kills the whole SARS corona family at point blank range. You know, so I mean, I'm sympathetic, as I alluded to a minute ago, I'm sympathetic to this idea that people should get to make their own choices about their healthcare decisions. But then you have a guy like this with no credentials and probably shouldn't say that online. He's just not really in a place where he should be talking about this. And he's trying to sell people a toothpaste that's going to kill a virus. You know, I just like that really can't be allowed, I don't think.
Yeah, it makes it tough because we tell people wash your hands to remove the virus. But you know, if you use toothpaste, I mean, I suppose it could have some sort of antiviral activity if it's, because you know, it foams, it has a surfactant quality to it. But it's not something that I think you can prescribe to kill a virus specifically. I don't know of any evidence of that efficacy being demonstrated.
And we can move on, but just the thought, you know, if this stuff really worked, I can't see why the bona fide experts wouldn't go, yeah, you know, buy his toothpaste or, you know, use essential oils. By all means, let's kill this thing. If it really worked, or if all of these things really worked, I don't see why there would be, you know, there'd be no reason not to use them. So it's just happy coincidence that these people are the only ones recommending these products.
Well, you know, I've been on this planet for 53 years and never used an essential oil. So they can't be that essential. And I'm leaning more towards optional oils because I just don't, they're not one of these compulsory products that I need to have. Toothpaste, on the other hand, all over it. Good times.
Yeah. Yeah. Use toothpaste by all means, everybody. Just don't think it's going to cure coronavirus. Oh, anyways, well, let's move on to something that's a little bit better news, and that's related to food safety. So this is a story from Garland West at Dirt to Dinner, and he's talking about why our food during this whole outbreak is generally safe. So, Kevin, give us a little insight on this, because I think you'll be able to speak to it better than I can.
Well, I think his idea was, you know, is our food safe? And it's kind of a strange question in some ways, because the article that he writes here says, well, there's no reason to assume that it's a higher risk. And it goes back to the concept of fomites. And fomites are the objects that vector disease inadvertently. So the contaminated products. And so we know that this thing can be spread by surface contamination. It's respiratory droplets, these aerosols that we create when we cough or sneeze or talk or breathe. They're alive. I shouldn't say alive. They're not alive. They're viable to induce infection for a number of hours to days. And when you look at the literature on this, and especially what's coming out in the major media, they're reporting these extended periods, like, oh, if 7 days later you can detect it. That doesn't mean that it's viable. It means that you can detect it using a very sensitive method that can detect it from genetic material. The viability is the question. And viability of the virus has been tested. It's something like a day on cardboard, a number of days on steel and plastic surfaces. So the big deal here is, can it survive on food? And so, you know, sure. I mean, I could it, but there's no evidence of that and no reason to have elevated concern.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think what the CDC has said and what other health authorities have said is that, you know, if you go shopping or when you go shopping, I should say, use an like a cleansing wipe or use Purell and rub down the cart that you're using. Make sure your hands are washed. Don't touch your face in public. That's the kind of stuff that'll, you know, keep you safe as you're handling food or buying food. And when you're cooking, make sure you cook things to the right temperature. These are just, you know, basic principles, but it's still sensible, especially in a situation like this. But on balance, would you say our food is safe?
Oh, absolutely. I think food is safe. And the rules that they're proposing are the same ones we always should use when we're talking about food. Wash your food. Cook it to the right temperatures. Wash the surfaces that you use to prepare them. Wash your hands when you're preparing food. Those are rules that I follow every single day. And so that's also the case here. When they're talking about things like grocery store, you know, wiping down the cart handles, all that stuff. That's stuff I never do, but I'm kind of thinking about doing now, just because of, you know, I need to keep myself healthy so I can be responsive at this time of need. You know, we're filling many gaps here in education. We're doing a lot of other things and delivering food in my community. There's a lot of things we're doing, and I got to be on the right side of the of wellness for this. So I am taking those extra steps too.
Yeah. Oh, and just by the way, I just thought of this, but it's probably worth mentioning, and he doesn't go into this in the article, but there's this idea floating around that somehow genetically engineered crops had something to do with this virus outbreak. And so there's no evidence for that. That's utter nonsense. And then the idea that maybe you should buy organic produce, or you should buy a certain brand of food or so on. There's nothing behind those ideas. So maybe you can comment on that, Kevin, as an agricultural scientist, but I just thought,
Just craziness. There's nothing to hang on there. You know, maybe one other thought that I had was that I do have a friend, a colleague at work, who he has been ordering his food for delivery. He has someone bring it, gives him a really good tip because people are losing their jobs. And he takes the food that they bring from the store and puts it in the quarantine for a few days. And then when he takes the packages out, he wipes them down. I mean, he's taken it to an extreme. But there are people out there who are using that kind of that level of care, and something that maybe some people would feel more comfortable in bringing into their program too.
Okay. So just precaution, really. Don't hole up in your house and stop eating. You're probably okay, but just be careful when you're out buying food, I think is the takeaway there. So speaking of food safety and moving on to our final story, Environmental Working Group, who, I'm not a big fan of, has put out their Dirty Dozen list this year. And for anyone that isn't familiar, this is a list of fruits and vegetables that EWG says are contaminated, quote unquote, with pesticide residues. And so I think I'll just let you lead with this one to you, Kevin, because you're, again, in a better position to comment.
Well, this is one that every year makes me so angry for a couple reasons. It's because it's a abject misrepresentation of science and data that are meant to make us feel better and to demonstrate that we are testing and ensuring the safety of food. And they take that same data and make it sound like your food is poison. And the problem with this is that it gets huge coverage in the major media. Huge coverage. I don't understand how they get so much coverage. And then it affects people's buying decisions, and mostly, and I guess we'll talk about this in a second, but let's start by talking about what they do. EWG, they take a look at USDA data. So USDA collects data on food, on pesticide residues on food, and they go through lots and lots of tests for many different compounds, and they write down, or they report how much is there. And they use very sensitive methods of detection from HPLC, GCMS, all LCMS, all these methods that we use in the lab to find things that are almost not there. Parts per billion, so seconds in 30 years. It is almost not there, but you can detect it. So what they report with EWG isn't that, well, that USDA surveyed all this stuff and chose a safe food supply because they detected things well under the range that we have to worry about. They say the numbers are not zero, and we can detect, or USDA has detected 31 different pesticides that are being used on strawberries. And it gives the consumer the idea that when they take that strawberry, that there's 31 different pesticides on there. And that's not true. I work with strawberry farmers. You see what they apply. This year it's been so dry, they almost don't have to apply anything. But when you do have some sort of an anticipated weather event that says you may get fungus growing, you can apply a few ounces per acre of a fungicide that targets that fungus so you don't get it on the strawberries and you don't harm the plants. And these stuffs are almost innocuous to humans if they are consumed, and then they're consumed in such vanishingly small amounts that they have absolutely no physiological relevance. Yet, the Environmental Working Group says the sky is falling. And this group too, I really can't stand that they do this.
Just to give those numbers you gave some context. So in order to even meet the maximum residue level for pesticides that the EPA sets, you'd have to eat 3,000 strawberries in a single day. And even if you were to do that, if your stomach didn't explode halfway through, you still wouldn't get enough, say, fungicide to cause yourself any harm because the EPA sets that threshold artificially low. And you can comment on this too, but I believe they will do animal tests to see how much they have to give the animal to make it sick or to get any kind of reaction out of it. And then they set it like 100 times lower than that. And that's what farmers have to adhere to. Can you elaborate on that?
No, that's exactly it. You come up with levels that are far below daily intake advising levels that are far below the minimum effect amount. So how much causes something to happen? Okay, that's where we detect it in a very sensitive detection and looking at these different physiological measures. And so we're going to go 100 or 1,000 times below that level as our maximum allowable. And still, they're not even getting close to the maximum allowable in something like 99% of examples. And once in a while, you find something that exceeds the maximum allowable level, once in a long while. But there's reasons for that, too, from mistakes in the test or from a farmer accidentally applying too much in one spot in the field that came up higher or whatever. There's so many reasons. But the bottom line is there is oversight. And the government is testing, and they're doing work to monitor and ensure that we're safe. Then they show with the data that the food is safe and that everything is below the levels. And then EWG says, well, not so fast. We don't believe those levels. We want new rules that are much lower. And we believe that the guidance should be much lower. And these folks aren't scientists. They're not toxicologists. They're not that isn't what they do. They're setting levels to scare the hell out of people and raise funds because of it.
Yeah, and I believe EWG has one toxicologist on staff, and she sort of like heads up this program and is the academic face of it. But when you read news articles about this, they'll usually say something describing what Kevin just talked about. And, you know, they'll say the USDA and the EPA set certain standards, but public health advocates say that those numbers are too high. And so if you're a parent and you don't follow this stuff day to day, that's very alarming to you. And, you know, if a public health advocate says that, well, they wouldn't say that if it wasn't true, you know? And so it's very manipulative and frankly dishonest.
Yeah.
So I wish they just give it up. Something tells me
the
won't.
Question is who does it harm? And when you tell people that strawberries are dangerous, and this comes out, you know, during, you know, what is the end of strawberry field or strawberry season in Florida and in the South, you're at the end of the strawberry season, you're lots of strawberries in the store, and now you scare people away from them. You harm the farmers. You harm the retailers that have to discard product. You generate food waste. You contribute to that. You scare the most vulnerable away from the best food that they should be eating. So instead of eating fruits and vegetables, they're fearing fruits and vegetables. And it's been shown very clearly that people who are told that their fruits and vegetables have pesticide residues, they just don't buy fruits and vegetables. So this is a very, very serious issue. And I wish that we had, I wish that scientists were given as much time to eat to this issue as EWG is.
Yeah. So I think we should leave it there. Let's just say your vegetables and your fruits are safe. You should keep eating them, especially during this time when everyone's worried about food security, even in, you know, developed countries like the United States. So your food's safe. And I think that EWG needs to stop publishing this list every year.
No, I hear you. I think it's very, very true. It's one of these things that I wish that the media would not give them all of the cred they give them and all the space they give them. I think it's it is a blatant misrepresentation of the science and the data, and we need to just ignore them.
Yep. And so every March when this comes out, why don't you guys just go to geneticliteracyproject.org, because we always have commentary on it from qualified scientists, and you'll be better off. And that's also where you can get this podcast. And Kevin, as always, give people your Twitter handle and your website.
Yeah, Twitter is at Kevin Folta. I also host the Talking Biotech podcast every Saturday morning. And right now, oh, I'm glad we thought of this. Every day of the week at 11 a.m., as long as this kids are out of school, I'm doing a lesson online on Facebook Live over at facebook.com, KM Folta, which is my professional Facebook page, and we cover a topic every single day. This week we did citrus disease, plant domestication, plants in light, and two other topics. And next week we're probably going to talk about viruses. We're going to talk about cows. And a young lady today who's 10 years old wanted to know about how you make new herbicides and pesticides. So we're going to have a fun week next week, every day at 11. And it's a great way to continue kids' education at home.
Yeah, very good. So check that out. And we are at Genetic Literacy on Twitter, and I am at Cam J. English. And we will see you guys next week with some more stories.